You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. On January 13th, Taiwanese voters elected Lai Ching-te of the pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party as their next president. Lai, who's also known as William Lai and is Taiwan's incumbent vice president, won a three-way race, besting Ho Yo-i of the Kuomintang and Ko Wen-ju of the Taiwan People's Party, also known as the TPP. The election centered around not just expressly domestic issues like the economy and energy, but also the very existential question of what type of relationship Taiwan should have with China. Today, while a distinctly Taiwanese identity is growing, most Taiwanese favor maintaining their de facto independence without pursuing that formally in order to avoid triggering a violent Chinese response. Beijing regards Taiwan as a breakaway province. But Taiwan's not the only country grappling with the China challenge. Many countries are, including the United States. And for the U.S., China's not just a competitor, but in the view of many, it's also an adversary. In 2018, the Trump administration publicly recognized the renewal of great power rivalry with a resurgent Russia and rising China. The competition with China is having a profound effect, not just on geopolitics, but also on the U.S. economy and the domestic political discourse. For example, we see the U.S. government reverting to a form of industrial policy, pouring billions of dollars in subsidies to deny China dominance over strategic technologies like electric vehicles and semiconductors. In this episode, we'll begin with a look at how Taiwan's elections may shape China's relationship with the island country and raise the prospects for a U.S.-China war over Taiwan. We'll then discuss what a U.S.-China clash over Taiwan might look like and whether the two countries have the tools to prevent an inadvertent war. And finally, we'll explore the broader issue of the strategic challenge that China poses to the U.S. and discuss what might be the best approach toward viewing and handling a rising China. To explore these questions, we're joined by Ali Wang, who is a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. Ali is the author of America's Great Power Opportunity, Revitalizing U.S. Foreign Policy to Meet the Challenges of Strategic Competition. He's previously worked for the Eurasia Group, the RAND Corporation, and many other esteemed organizations. Ali, as you'll notice, is a very lucid thinker, and we're lucky to have him on. Ali, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So Taiwan just had its presidential elections, and while the pro-independence DPP is returning to power for a third consecutive term, its vote share fell below 50% and it lost its legislative majority. We also saw a pretty impressive performance from the Third Way TPP, which advocates a more cautious approach toward Beijing. So before we get to the question of China's reaction to the elections, how do you read the election results, and what does it say about the Taiwanese public's views of the status quo and their relationship with Beijing?
Well, I would offer a few reactions. The first, as you said, and in fact, you know, William Lai, he secured only a little over 40% of the vote, and it seemed quite plausible up until recently that this opposition coalition between the KMT and the TPP, up until recently, it did seem plausible that that opposition coalition might actually prevail. I think had it been more disciplined, had it been more organized, we may have been talking about a different outcome. So I think the first reaction is that the outcome arguably has less to do with, you know, William Lai's sort of popularity among the Taiwanese public than with the perhaps the incoherence or the inability to organize on the part of these two opposition parties, number one. You know, the second reaction I would offer is that, you know, there is a tendency among many observers, and it's an understandable tendency, but I think can sometimes be misguided or myopic, a tendency to view Taiwan principally, if not exclusively, through the aperture of increasing strategic or intensifying strategic competition between the United States and China. And You know, my sense based on what I've been reading and conversations that I've been having with those who have been following cross-strait tensions for a long time is that this election in many ways was less about cross-strait tensions than it was about internal issues. I think that there has been a bubbling, you know, percolating discontent in among the Taiwanese public with housing prices, with the state of the economy. And so even though William Lai did ultimately prevail, as you said, his party, the DPP, did lose legislative control. So that would be the second reaction, is that I think that William Lai will have a challenging road ahead in terms of governing a divided, you know, divided parliament, and also managing a growing discontent with various socioeconomic issues. So I think that those would be sort of two initial, you know, reactions. And then the third, and I imagine that we'll perhaps, you know, dwell on this point at some length, you know, later in our conversation, but just going back to that second reaction that I offered, or the first couple of reactions that I offered, I think that as the United States thinks about how it engages with, you know, Taiwan, it's important, again, not to view Taiwan solely through the aperture of a strategic competition with China, and to think about not only how to view Taiwan outside of that aperture, but also how to engage with Taiwan more broadly and how to strengthen non-military aspects of its relationship with Taiwan. So whether it's strengthening economic relations, diplomatic relations, information relations. So why don't I stop there? But those are just some initial reactions.
Right. Now, when we look at China's reaction to the Taiwan elections, and unfortunately, I am sort of sticking to that that great power rivalry frame. I appreciate your clarification on the fact that this is not just, the election wasn't simply just about the China factor, that the Taiwanese have their own domestic issues, whether it's the economy and energy and other issues. And so, you know, all politics is local, but when it comes to the Taiwanese, China is pretty local too. It's not too far away.
Of course.
And so, so that is, you know, sort of the elephant in the room, if not a major election issue too, right? So when we look at China's reaction to the elections, it scolded countries for congratulating Taiwan on the election results. And it's also asserted that Taiwan is part of China's territory. Is this boilerplate stuff, or is it more bellicose than what we usually hear from China after a major Taiwan election?
I think that China's reaction was largely kind of baked in, and I think that most observers who were speculating about the outcome of Taiwan's presidential election anticipated that if William Lai were to prevail as he did, that China would react in the ways that it is reacting. So obviously, you see, you know, China's denunciations of leaders who congratulated William Lai on his victory. You know, China's denunciation of a high-level bipartisan delegation of former U.S. officials who recently visited Taiwan. We've seen sort of an uptick just recently in Chinese maneuvers around military maneuvers around the island. But I think that all of those reactions were, I would say, are well within the range of what observers had expected. I think we'll have to see what transpires in terms of China's, you know, reactions. We'll have to see what transpires in the weeks and months ahead. But thus far, what we've seen, I think most observers would say that it's well within the range of expectations. And I think it's important to, the reason that I am sort of underscoring that point is that there is a lot of speculation, again, understandable, and there's a lot of anxiety, again, understandable, about the prospect for, you know, an attempted Chinese invasion of Taiwan or some other kind of attack against, you know, Taiwan. You know, my sense is that, you know, we certainly can't disclaim that possibility. And if you are a policy planner, especially in the national security community, you would be very remiss to ignore those kind of catastrophic contingencies. But my sense is that China's cross-strait strategy, as it were, it's less focused on kind of that extreme scenario of sort of going for the jugular, attempting an all-out amphibious landing and staging an invasion of Taiwan. And instead, I think that China is thinking about implementing a much more sort of patient, long-term, multifaceted strategy. And in this regard, I've been really influenced by an argument that Bonnie Glaser and Jude Blanchett put out. They wrote an article recently in War on the Rocks, and they talk about kind of a multifaceted, what they call strangulation strategy. And the idea is that if China, through military coercion, certainly, but also through economic coercion, diplomatic coercion, information coercion, but if China, through a variety of vectors, a variety of sort of parallel reinforcing vectors of effort, can grind down Taiwan psychologically, and if over the medium to long term, China can convince Taiwan that Taipei, in due course, will eventually have to settle cross-strait tensions on Beijing's preferred terms, then China would much rather opt for that patient, long-term, multifaceted strategy, which is relatively low cost, as opposed to a very high-risk strategy of attempting to invade Taiwan. Now, I don't want to suggest that there are intermediate possibilities. So there are observers who worry about the possibility of a naval blockade, of the Taiwan Strait. So there are other intermediate possibilities between an all-out invasion and this sort of patient, multifaceted, long-term strategy. But I think that China's reaction thus far, its reactions rather thus far, have been relatively muted, have been relatively within the range of expectations. It doesn't mean that China isn't incrementally dialing up the pressure. It certainly is. But I think we'll have to wait to see in the weeks and months ahead if China reacts in ways that are beyond the beyond sort of the continuum of what observers had been expecting.
Right. And, you know, for that strategy of strangulation to work, there has to be a credibility to China's threats of an invasion, right? And so as we see China regularizing these military incursions that are close to Taiwan's shores and into its quote-unquote air defense identification zone, which is its kind of de facto airspace, how do we distinguish between the signals and the noise in terms of this aggressive behavior that we'll likely continue to see from Beijing over the years?
Right. And I think that this question really hits the nail on the head. You know, how do you distinguish between, you know, how do you distinguish between steps that China would take if it actually were countenancing sort of a full-fledged invasion of Taiwan versus steps that it would take just in the service of this kind of this patient, you know, long-term multifaceted strategy? And I would be remiss to suggest that it's always easy to distinguish. And I suspect I wouldn't be surprised if intelligence establishments around the world are focusing very intently, precisely on this question. I guess I would offer a few thoughts. One is I think it's important, and you really can't overstate the significance of some of the turbulence that we've seen recently in the top echelons of the People's Liberation Army. There's been a lot of commentary, again, understandably, on Xi Jinping's his exhortation that he wants the PLA to have the capacity to invade Taiwan by 2027, but it's important to distinguish between capacity and intention. And my interpretation, at least one partial interpretation of a lot of the turbulence that we're seeing in the top rungs of the PLA, is that Xi Jinping doesn't yet have that confidence in the PLA's professionalism, in its ability or its willingness to root out corruption, in its operational capacity. And I don't think that Xi Jinping would authorize an invasion of Taiwan unless he were to believe that the PLA had sufficiently rooted out corruption, had sufficiently increased its operational capacity. So one reaction is, you know, in terms of sort of signals that we should be paying attention to, what level of confidence does Xi Jinping display publicly in the readiness, the operational readiness of the PLA? And I think that Xi Jinping has been signaling with some of these recent sort of shuffles in the top ranks that he's not yet confident, number one. Number two, and there's been a lot of sort of debate on this point around the world, sort of trying to sort of get inside Xi Jinping's head and get inside the heads of his top advisors and suss out what Chinese officials, sort of what their assessment is of China's medium to long-term strategic outlook. And, one concern is that as the Indo-Pacific military environment becomes more congested, more contested, more complicated, and given that growing sort of complexity of China's military environment and China's own internal issues, whether it's seemingly a structurally slowing rate of growth, demographic decline, one concern is, does China believe that its strategic outlook is dimming? And does it believe, therefore, that it has sort of a narrowing window of opportunity in which to achieve certain vital national interests, first and foremost among them being Taiwan's reunification with the mainland? You know, my sense is, so another signal to watch. So the first signal that I mentioned is, how is Xi Jinping talking publicly or expressing himself publicly in terms of the readiness of the PLA? A second signal that we should watch for is Xi Jinping's sort of sense of China's strategic outlook. If Xi Jinping and his top advisors were to signal a fundamental pessimism about China's medium to long-term strategic outlook, that signal would indeed be very concerning. But if you look at, for example, just very recently, if you look at Xi Jinping's report to the 20th Party Congress, if you look at statements that he's made subsequent to the 20th Party Congress, sure, Xi Jinping, I think he has been a bit chastened by developments of the past few years. I think that he recognizes that China's economy is in a bit of a rough patch. He recognizes that advanced industrial democracies are increasingly coalescing to put pressure on China economically, technologically, and otherwise. So I think that he recognizes that internally and externally, that China's challenges are probably greater in number and greater in severity than they were at the beginning of the 2020s. But I, at least, based on what we know publicly and what we can read and see publicly, I don't as of yet see evidence that Xi Jinping and his top advisors have changed their fundamental assessment that the East, broadly, and China specifically, will continue to rise, and that the West and the United States specifically will enter into a phase of terminal decline. I don't see evidence that those fundamental assessments have changed. So just to summarize, if Xi Jinping believes that, expresses publicly or signals publicly that he believes that the PLA has the requisite operational readiness that he would deem necessary to invade Taiwan, and if he were to signal, if he and his top advisors were to signal publicly a fundamental pessimism about China's medium to long-term strategic outlook, I think that combination would be cause for concern, but I don't think that we're there yet. I'll just make one last point, and maybe we can talk a little bit about sort of the dynamics between China and Russia later. But obviously, I think that the lessons that China is learning from Russia's invasion of Ukraine are still in the process of being learned. And depending on how the war between Russia and Ukraine concludes, China might update the lessons that it's learning. But I think based on where we are today, I think it's fair to say that China did not expect when Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin met in February of 2022, a few weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine, I don't think that either Putin or Xi expected that Russia and Ukraine would still be fighting. And now the Russia-Ukraine war is approaching almost its two-year mark. And you'll remember, obviously, before Russia invaded Ukraine, when Russia did invade Ukraine, given the extant imbalance between Russia's conventional military forces and those of Ukraine, plus the fact that Russia has the world's largest nuclear arsenal and Ukraine doesn't have nuclear weapons, many observers around the world thought that the war would be over in a matter of days. And what we see is that despite that imbalance, if an authoritarian leader receives poor advice from intelligence officials, from military officials, even that conventional imbalance can be for naught, or can be for much less than it otherwise ought to accomplish. And I think that one of China's takeaways is, look, you need to make sure that before you countenance, sort of go for the jugular or countenance very aggressive military action, you need to ensure that you're getting the highest quality advice from your intelligence officials and military officials, number one. And number two, I think another takeaway that China is having from Russia's difficulties in Ukraine is that Russia didn't go nearly far enough in winnowing its dependence on the dollar, winnowing its technological dependence on the United States. And so I think that China now is really moving much more assiduously and vigorously to try and reduce its interdependence with the United States, to reduce its dependence on the U.S. dollar, to cultivate greater technological self-sufficiency. And I think that China recognizes, given its extant integration into the global economy and given its extant dependence on the West in particular for technological inputs, that it's nowhere near achieving financial and technological self-sufficiency. So all a way of saying that I don't see evidence yet that China is imminently preparing to attack Taiwan. I think that China would prefer, if it could, to, again, opt for that that more patient strategy that Bonnie Glazer and Jude Blanchett presented in their recent War on the Rocks piece.
Now, if a prerequisite for an invasion would be that, you know, China would have to shape a geoeconomic framework that in which it's, you know, far less dependent on the West, then that would suggest that the horizon or the timeline for an invasion of Taiwan would be much further out than many of the dates that are mentioned in sort of the popular discourse and to some extent the scholarly discourse when people talk about 2027 and 2030. It'll take much longer, I think, to develop a kind of economic autonomy because China, unlike Russia and unlike the Soviet Union, is so so crucial to the global economy, and its export industries are vital to its own economic dynamism as well. And then, you know, there is a sort of disaggregation of the economic productive process where inputs come from all different parts of the world, even if they're the final manufacturing is conducted in China. So that level of interdependence, you know, may, in the view of some, serve as a counterweight against a kind of immediate clash over Taiwan. There may be an interest on both sides or multiple sides, on the U.S. side, the Taiwanese side, and the Chinese side, to avoid an immediate clash over Taiwan. But there's potential for an inadvertent crisis. And there have been several estimates of the costs of a war over Taiwan. And Bloomberg Economics has conducted an assessment recently, and it said a war over Taiwan would hit the world's economy to the tune of $10 trillion, or around 10% of global GDP. Taiwan itself would lose 40% of GDP in its first year. China would lose around 17%. And then, of course, global supply chains would be totally upended, whether it's, you know, or flip-flops or smartphones or electric cars. And then CSIS, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank, conducted a war game in 2022. And it concluded that the U.S. and Taiwan would be able to defeat a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, but it would be at great cost. So we're talking about tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers dying, dozens of ships and hundreds of aircraft lost. So it's clear that all actors would pay a high price over a war of over Taiwan. And so, you know, it may be the case that all are kind of determined to achieve their goals without war. But what I'd like you to talk to us about is whether the United States and China have mechanisms in place to prevent and manage a crisis so that an all-out war is avoided. You know, in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the U.S. and USSR established crisis management channels like a direct hotline. So let's say the temperature continues to rise in the Taiwan Strait and the South China or the South China Sea. What type of crisis management mechanisms do the U.S. and China have in place? And in your view, are they adequate?
I think that you're, well, first, just a few reactions, because you covered a lot of ground, and just there are a number of reactions that, you know, that went through my mind as you were talking. So I just wanted to make a quick comment on sort of the first part of your question. And you're absolutely right that, you know, interdependence for the time being, you know, it might serve as a, you know, it might serve to sort of to lower the odds of confrontation. But, you know, one of my concerns, and I wrote a short piece sort of expressing this concern last year, you know, one of my concerns is a scenario in which, and it's not a short-term scenario, it's more of sort of a medium to long-term scenario, but a scenario in which, you know, China, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years hence, I don't know what the exact time horizon would be, but if China were to, you know, again, conducting, you know, with assiduousness and with vigor, if China over the medium to long run were to achieve or were to eclipse a certain threshold of financial self-sufficiency, a certain threshold of technological self-sufficiency, a China that was largely financially and technologically self-contained and self-sufficient, I think could potentially be even more prone to aggressive action. Because again, you know, one of China's concerns right now, especially having witnessed the sanctions that the West has, you know, has imposed upon Russia, which, by the way, are the most sweeping sanctions that have ever been imposed since World War II on an economy of Russia's size. I think that one of China's concerns is, well, goodness, on the one hand, the fact that we are so deeply embedded in the global economy, it gives us economic leverage, but that precise degree of exposure also, it's kind of a double-edged sword. And so So I worry about a scenario in which a more economically, not autarkic, but a more economically autonomous China over the medium to long run might actually be more prone to sort of military adventurism in the Indo-Pacific. So I just wanted to put out that, to express that concern. On your question about kind of, you know, mechanisms for de-escalation, and, you know, you hit on one of my greatest concerns, and I think it's a widely shared concern. You know, we know from history that often the most dangerous phase of sort of an incipient competition or even, you know, rivalry or antagonism, one of the most dangerous, you know, phases, it's before kind of a Cuban Missile Crisis style event occurs, because, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, it really focused the minds of policymakers in the United States and the Soviet Union. And when you are peering across the precipice of nuclear Armageddon, you know, and you recognize, you know, the stakes, you recognize the potential consequences of your brinkmanship, you ideally, you sort of, you walk back from the brink. But until and unless you approach that point, you are more inclined to probe each other's red lines. Maybe you don't even know what each other's red lines are, but you're more willing to probe, you're more willing to test, you're more willing to challenge. And so when you look at the Cold War, I think the one could argue, and historians, they disagree over sort of the precise demarcation, but let's say roughly, you could say between, you could say 1949 and 1962. I think that phase of the Cold War was arguably far more dangerous than the second phase of the Cold War post-Cuban Missile Crisis. And as you said, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States and the Soviet Union, they established hotlines, they signed various, you know, agreements to put in place protocols if there were encounters at sea or encounters in the air. And I wouldn't want to suggest that those protocols and agreements and arrangements were cure-all, certainly not, and there were many close calls. Including close calls that nearly led the United States and the Soviet Union to the brink of nuclear war. But they nonetheless, they did mollify, I think, antagonism between the United States and the Soviet Union. And as bad as the relationship is right now, currently between the United States and Russia, at least we can say that there are some vestiges of those understandings, kind of some Cold War vestiges that have helped, I think, the United States and Russia today to avoid entering into a direct armed confrontation. All the way of saying, sort of by way of context, that unfortunately, for various reasons, the United States and China have been unable to forge sort of similar understandings. And there are many reasons, but I would say the one, I think one important reason that the United States and China have not been able to establish kind of comparable military to military understandings is that Washington and Beijing, they conceptualize the utility of military to military dialogue very differently. So, you know, sitting here, I live in Washington, I work in Washington. And so when you go around town, when you talk to, you know, members of Congress, when you talk to members of, you know, of the administration, I think that from a US perspective, establishing hotlines, establishing de-escalation protocols, I think that, you know, members of Congress and US government officials regard those types of measures as self-evidently meritorious. You know, China, on the other hand, I think that China believes that the establishment of those measures is kind of, I think that China tends to discern sort of more ulterior motives behind the establishment of those protocols and believes that those protocols are essentially a pretext, A, for boxing in China militarily, and B, for allowing the United States and its Indo-Pacific allies and partners to project a greater military power in the region. And so there's a fundamental divergence between the way that the United States conceptualizes the utility of these measures and the way that China does. Now, having said that, I am encouraged that we are seeing a resumption of military dialogue since the visit to Taiwan of former U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So it's good that we have seen a resumption of dialogue, but that resumption of dialogue is starting from a very low baseline. So it's good that that dialogue is resumed, and there now seems to be a certain cadence of military to military communication. But again, it's starting from a very low level. The United States and China do not have a comparable military to military dialogue apparatus, such as the one that Washington and Moscow had during the Cold War, which means, to your question, that the risk of inadvertent escalation is not only significant, but it's growing. And it's growing in part just because the Indo-Pacific is just becoming more congested. So despite the war between Russia and Ukraine, despite this crisis in the Middle East that seems to be escalating by the day, the United States still is shifting an ever greater portion of its naval fleet to the Indo-Pacific. China, of course, is rapidly building up its own naval fleet. And if you read sort of the top lines from the Department of Defense's recently released report on China's military modernization, you know, the Pentagon documents in quite sobering detail the number of near misses between U.S. and Chinese naval assets, U.S. and Chinese aerial assets. Again, it's somewhat encouraging that in recent months, I think certainly since the publication of that report, the number of near misses seems to have declined. But I am worried that just as the Indo-Pacific militarily becomes more congested with just greater U.S. and Chinese assets in the waters and in the skies, and given this extant lack of trust and this lack of dialogue in a robust way between the United States and China, that risk of inadvertent escalation is significant and growing. And I'll just make one last point. You mentioned the Bloomberg article, and I would commend it to all of your listeners. I think that Jennifer Welch at Bloomberg, and she used to be at the National Security Council, I think that she and her colleagues have really done, I think that they've performed a very important public service with that report. One of the concerns that I have is that a lot of the analysis that we see about a hypothetical conflict between the United States and China, it tends to focus on the initial days, weeks, months of a conflict. But I think that more and more scholars, Iskander Rehman, for example, who has just published a terrific book, there are more and more scholars who are arguing, or at least speculating, that a conflict between the United States and China would actually be much more protracted. And so for that reason, a conflict between the United States and China, a direct armed conflict between the United States and China, it would be unprecedented in scale, it would be unprecedented in scope, and it's really difficult. It really tests the limits, or really tests the capacity of imagination to document in full, or to imagine in full, the full litany of consequences that could emerge from a war. And so I think that one of the reasons that I really appreciated that report by Jennifer Welch and her colleagues at Bloomberg is we need more analysis that places in stark relief the litany of consequences that would unfold if, in the case of a protracted conflict between the United States and China, and costs measured in terms of the human toll, the economic toll, the military toll. A conflict between the United States and China would almost assuredly, it would decimate the semiconductor industry overnight, the semiconductor industry upon which the global economy inordinately depends. It would plunge the global economy into recession. It would result in an inconceivable human toll and military toll. And it would basically, I think it would be a death knell for any vestiges of what we call kind of the post-war international order. So I think that we need more analysis that focuses on the possibility that a U.S.-China conflict would be protracted. We need more analysis that lays in full view the range of consequences that would come from such a conflict. And I think the more that we document those types of consequences and present them to policymakers in both Washington and Beijing, the more that hopefully we can walk them back from that fatal precipice.
Right. And, you know, there are the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. And when we look at, events of the past decade or so, whether it's the Syrian war or the COVID pandemic or Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we can look at it at a sort of the initial impact. But, you know, the Syrian war, for example, transformed European politics. COVID has led to a kind of a denialism in American culture, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine has a heightened sort of resistance to the West or Western concepts of geopolitics from the so-called global South. And so,
right,
given the geography and the economic implications and the potential for the loss of military lives as well as civilian lives as a result of a war over Taiwan, you know, we can war game what happens in that initial conflict, but there are these unknown unknowns. And
absolutely.
You had made this earlier comment about the possibility that traditional crisis management mechanisms might not work with China, and in part because, you know, the Beltway has a tendency to mirror image, and strategic thinkers in China and the policy elite may view, you know, those mechanisms as ulterior pathways to achieve other objectives, right? And that points to the question of strategic culture. So we have these really conflicting views of Beijing strategy under Xi Jinping. And And some argue that there is a really distinctive, more aggressive strategic culture under Xi, and that these crisis management mechanisms won't work because there's actually a belief there that escalation is the pathway to resolving a crisis and not, you know, resorting to these hotlines and these other crisis management channels that, you know, for example, the US and the USSR had used and many other countries that are at conflict or have a kind of a cold relationship have leveraged. But then there are others that say China is being misread in many ways, including, for example, on its nuclear expansion. According to reporting, according to US government assessments, as well as independent assessments, China's nuclear program is one of the fastest growing in the world. And Taylor Fravel, and he's co-authored this piece with several other colleagues that I found to be very fantastic. It's in Foreign Affairs. And he examines the Chinese strategic literature on the nuclear question. And his basic argument is that Chinese strategic thinkers, you know, view the U.S. as increasingly threatening China's nuclear deterrent by lowering the threshold for nuclear attacks. And you know, they cite, you know, some U.S. thinkers who've, you know, recommended the possibility of the use of low-yield nukes in a Taiwan conflict, so nuclear weapons in a non-nuclear conflict. And so the idea here is that the kind of hawkishness one may see here in Washington actually incentivizes greater hawkishness in Beijing. And so I'm wondering, how do you square these two divergent schools of thought on Beijing? Some see China as, to some extent, reacting to the hawkishness in Washington, whereas others say that, no, Xi Jinping has this concept of national rejuvenation. And an inherent part of it is this really more assertive, China's no longer biding its time. Now it's time to bite.
Yeah. And I guess my, not to be evasive or not to sound, not to sound lawyerly, but it's actually not clear to me that those sort of two, I guess you could say, hypotheses or accounts are entirely in tension. And I think that there are elements of truth to both of them. So I would say certainly, you know, under Xi Jinping, I do think, you know, I do very much believe that. Do I think that some hardening of the U.S.-China relationship was likely sort of baked in the cake just on account of structural factors? I'm willing to be persuaded of that argument, but do I think that the relationship would be in the place that it is today, were there different leaders? I'm not so sure. I do think that Xi Jinping's imprimatur is very distinctive. A number of scholars have pointed out that, you know, before Xi Jinping, it's not as though, you know, growing tensions between the United States and China began when Xi Jinping took the helm of China, and that in fact, even before, you know, even during sort of the Hu Jintao years, we had been seeing sort of mounting tensions between Washington and Beijing. But certainly Xi Jinping he's a different leader. He's a different kind of leader. I think that he views himself in much more kind of historic, grandiose terms than perhaps some of his predecessors. So he's more ambitious. He is more, I think, convinced of sort of his singular role in bringing about this national rejuvenation, you know, that he talks about. And if you look at some of the steps that he's undertaken at the helm, you know, whether it is, you know, purging political opponents, consolidating more and more political authority, whether it is, you know, making clear that while he wants to maintain a robust rate of growth, that he's no longer willing to privilege economic growth over political control, and that now that hierarchy of priorities has been reversed, I think, under Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping is willing and I think inclined to prioritize the CCP's political control over the achievement of a certain arbitrary rate of economic growth. If you look at his foreign policy actions, whether sort of in the Indo-Pacific or beyond, I think it's difficult to argue that, you know, Xi Jinping is just a kind of sort of another incarnation of, say, Hu Jintao or Jiang Zemin. I think that his imprimatur is significant, it's distinctive, and he is a more ambitious and confident, you know, leader of China. So certainly, you know, personalities matter. And I think that also, you know, personalities matter here, you know, in the United States. If you look, for example, at the kind of the split between, say, the Obama administration and the Trump administration, I think that the Obama administration, tried to, balance, tried to balance sort of more competitive dynamics of the relationship and more cooperative elements. And I think that there was a hope in the Obama administration that some compartmentalization could take place. And that is to say that even as the relationship between Washington and Beijing grew more competitive, that the United States and China could still cooperate and engage with one another in quite robust ways on a range of transnational issues. You know, when the Trump administration came into office, it adopted a pretty radically different conception of what one might call the so-called China challenge. And so if you look at its national security strategy and its national defense strategy, you know, the Trump administration presented China in much more zero-sum adversarial terms. The Trump administration, I think, came into office believing that economic interdependence between the United States and China was not sort of a net force for stability in the relationship, but on balance, it was a vector through which China could exploit the United States economically. And so the Trump administration came into office with a very different overall conception of China. It came into office with a very different conception of the salutary benefits or perhaps lack thereof in its view of economic interdependence. So personalities matter. Personalities matter in the relationship. And so I think that just to circle back to your question, I think that Xi Jinping is a different kind of leader in the pantheon of Chinese leaders. And so I think that one can't discount the role that he has played. But inevitably, you know, as the expression goes, it takes two to tango. And the United States is reacting to China. China is reacting to the United States. And so there is, and that kind of that reactiveness, the way that the United States and China react to one another, it would be, I think that it would be unwise to suggest that either the United States is making China policy in a vacuum or that China is making policy towards the United States in a vacuum. And maybe I'll just sort of stop with one comment, which it's really a concern. The concern that I have about the trajectory of the relationship going forward is that even though I do think that we are right now experiencing kind of a fragile thaw between the two countries, and we can perhaps get into reasons why that thaw has emerged, but we now have crossed a certain Rubicon in the relationship. The United States and China have very publicly now and very repeatedly made clear their assessments of each other's intentions. So the United States, I would say on a bipartisan basis, has made the argument, or U.S. officials and members of Congress have repeatedly and publicly said that China wants to, become the world's preeminent power. And China, for its part, Xi Jinping, he used to say that there are certain countries, and when he would say certain countries, that term was widely understood to be code for the United States. But last year, I believe for the first time, Xi Jinping said Western countries led by the United States. So he publicly and explicitly singled out the United States. And he said that there are these Western countries led by the United States that are trying to, I'm forgetting his exact phraseology, but something like encircle, contain, and suppress China. So when the United States publicly and explicitly says that China is trying to overtake us for global preeminence, and when China publicly and explicitly says that the United States is trying to contain us, you can't put those genies back into bottles. And so I think that now, given that those assessments have been publicly and repeatedly and quite forcefully articulated, we've crossed a certain threshold in the relationship. So the question now is not how we revert to a certain status quo, which I don't think is coming back. The question is, given that this relationship is now and increasingly will be fundamentally competitive, how do you circumscribe competition in a way that, first and most importantly, you avoid a direct armed confrontation? And secondly, how do you preserve a certain baseline of diplomatic and military interactions? And third, how do you preserve some space for, however limited it might be, but some space for a transnational or cooperation on transnational challenges? And so I think that the objectives for the relationship are today, I think, far more modest in both Washington and Beijing than they were. You'll remember it wasn't too long ago, as recently as a decade ago, that U.S. officials and their Chinese interlocutors were talking about a, quote, a new model of great power relations, a quite lofty, grandiose ambition for the relationship. Now, neither U.S. nor Chinese officials talk in sort of using that terminology anymore. I think they're much more modest in their expectations. So the expectations are much more modest. The risks in the relationships are greater. And I think that the real question for both the United States and China is, if both countries believe that managed competition or competitive coexistence is the way of the future, is sort of the steady state of the relationship, how will the two countries get there? What does competitive coexistence look like in practice? And what concessions, if any, will both countries have to make, not only in order to achieve competitive coexistence in the first instance, but also to sustain it for the medium to long term?
Right, right. Now, President Xi and Biden met in San Francisco in November, and then since then, the countries have held a number of bilateral talks, at some of which you've mentioned, including the first defense talks since 2021. And this fits into a kind of pattern of what you've talked about in terms of trying to manage this competition. What exactly is the Biden administration trying to achieve? And then, you know, come November, if Donald Trump is elected as president again, how might a second Trump administration differ?
So my sense of the Biden administration's, you know, policy towards China is, I think that there are a few components. So the first, and I would argue, I think the most important component is you have to invest anew in your unique competitive advantages. And so for the United States, domestically, it's your ecosystem of innovation, it's your system of higher education, it's your ability to attract, you know, talent from around the world. So it's investing again kind of in the domestic foundations of your competitiveness. And then abroad, it means, you know, reinvigorating your core alliances and partnerships. And so at home, it means the passage of the CHIPS and Science Act, the passage of an infrastructure bill, the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act. And then abroad, it's the reinvigoration of NATO, it's the reinvigoration of the Quad. And I think that increasingly, an attempt to kind of to stitch together alliances and partnerships in Europe and the Indo-Pacific. So I think so one component is just, you know, broadly, you know, identifying, you know, what are our meaning Americas, you know, what are our unique competitive advantages and how do we sort of invest in them anew and replenish them? So that's sort of component one. Component two is, I think, a recognition that the United States unilaterally is not going to be able to sort of induce China to change how it comports itself, particularly at home. I think that there was not an assumption, but I think that certainly on the part of many U.S. Policymakers, I think certainly at least in the early 1990s, there was an assumption, but a hope that as China's economic clout grew, as China's integration into the global economy, you know, grew, that China might not, you know, democratize, but that it might incrementally over time, it might grow more liberal in its political orientation. And I think that we've seen that hope has not materialized. What we've seen instead is that, yes, China has economically grown more powerful, but it also has grown more authoritarian. And so I think that this administration is focusing less on trying to sort of induce political change in China, and instead it's trying to focus more on shaping sort of China's external environment, and particularly by whether it's reinvigorating the Quad, whether it's trying to sort of be a more appealing partner to, you know, member countries of ASEAN. So there's, I think, a second component is focusing less on trying to induce political change in China and trying to focus more on shaping China's external operating environment or its external strategic outlook. And then third and finally is, you know, albeit, you know, with modesty and humility, trying to, you know, maintain a certain cadence of diplomatic and military interactions, trying to preserve some space for cooperation, however limited it might be, on transnational challenges. And I will say that, again, I don't want to strike too optimistic a note, but I have been, you know, moderately encouraged by, you know, some of the results that we've seen over the past few months. So, you know, we've seen, at least for the time being, a reduction in the frequency of near misses between U.S. and Chinese military assets in the Indo-Pacific. We've seen, at least on paper, an agreement between the United States and China on fentanyl precursors. The United States and China, I believe, will soon be launching a dialogue, trying to sort of consider, identify, and mitigate the consequences of sort of the potential military consequences of growing increasingly sophisticated artificial intelligence capabilities. We see now I don't know if the delegation has already arrived, but there will soon be a delegation, I believe, maybe it's already en route, a delegation of officials from the U.S. Treasury will be speaking with their counterparts in China about how to promote not only greater predictability economically in the bilateral relationship, but also how to foster greater macroeconomic stability more broadly. So we see a number of encouraging, albeit modest, but nonetheless encouraging developments. But I think that the medium to long term outlook, you know, for the relationship is it is fundamentally competitive. It will grow increasingly so. So I think so. If President Biden is reelected, you know, my sense is that multi-part sort of disaggregation that I try to present, there might be tweaks around the margins. There might be touches up or modifications or polishes here and there. But I think that underlying approach will, I suspect, would likely endure in a second Biden administration. If President Trump were to be reelected, you know, my sense is that under a second Trump administration, that the United States would accelerate quite significantly and expand quite significantly the scope of so-called de-risking to the point of trying to approach decoupling. So this word decoupling gets bandied about a lot. I think that given the extant level of interdependence between Washington and Beijing, actual decoupling or theoretical decoupling, I think, is really an impossibility. But you could certainly imagine with a much more, you know, sort of determined, you know, focused administration in this regard, you could imagine the United States and China, you could imagine that their economies would become much more forcibly separated in a wider array of sectors. So if President Trump were to be reelected, I would expect more aggressive de-risking and a more concerted effort to actually decouple the economies, even though, again, I don't think the economies can be decoupled. I think that also there would be just more unpredictability. When President Trump, you know, during the first Trump administration, you know, I think that, you know, President Trump himself was rather mercurial in his own disposition. And so on certain days, he would sound more upbeat about his interactions with President Xi. On other days, he would be much more pessimistic. On some days, he would be much more excited about the possibility of striking a trade deal with China. On other days, he was much bleaker. So one, you know, the president himself was quite unpredictable in his pronouncements on China. And then in terms of the actions that he took, I think that one of the reasons that U.S. allies and partners were perhaps a little bit, I think, thrown off balance by some of the Trump administration's policies towards China. One, the Trump administration, it tended to lean into a little bit more of an existential framing of China, kind of this Manichaean zero-sum framing that even U.S. allies and partners with strong apprehensions about China's resurgence were uncomfortable to embrace. And also the Trump administration, when it took actions targeting China, it very often, with the same sort of stroke of a pen, also targeted U.S. allies and partners, for example, with economic penalties. And so that kind of, that tendency to take actions that sort of caught U.S. allies and partners in the crosshairs, I think, introduced an element of unpredictability into U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration. And so that unpredictability during a second Trump administration, it could potentially raise the risk of inadvertent escalation. I would also just make one last comment, which is that I think that in a second Trump administration, I think that China would probably be more inclined to and more capable, more inclined to and more willing to and more able to perhaps divide and conquer and kind of pull the United States away from some of its core allies and partners. Because, you know, it's, I think that what China would say is that, look, you know, the vagaries of America's domestic politics mean that U.S. foreign policy is, it's unpredictable, it's unreliable. So those are some of the differences. So I think that, you know, at the 30,000 foot view, I think that the U.S.-China relationship will continue to grow more competitive, whether President Biden is reelected or whether President Trump is reelected. But I think that under a second Biden administration, I think that we would see a kind of a tweaking of, a polishing of, an advancement of the approach that we currently see. Whereas under a Trump administration, there would be much more unpredictability.
Right. Yeah. Now, you had mentioned how the Trump administration tended to frame the China challenge as one as existential. And then many liken the conflict to a new Cold War. They've also kind of embedded in that framing is this expectation of an end state, a victory like the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. In your view, what's the most appropriate way to frame and view the China challenge? Because there's also the risk that we could exaggerate or embellish or overestimate China's strategic impact on us and actually allow it to determine not just our grand strategy, but also our domestic politics and culture. So what's the best way to view the China challenge?
I strongly agree with the premises that I think are embedded in your question. And as for the phrase or the conception of a new Cold War, I mean, I am critical of it, but I should preface my criticism by saying that I understand its appeal. The United States, at least in the post-war era, the United States only has one example of long-term strategic competition. So it's kind of a data set of, N equals one. And so when you only have, one case study upon which to draw, you're going to milk it for as much value as you can get. But there's a risk when you're drawing on a limited data set, there's a risk that you not only overlearn the right lessons, but that you also learn some of the wrong lessons. And there are many distinctions between, there are many reasons why I think that the Cold War is probably an improper source of analytical and prescriptive guidance to policymakers today. But just, you use this term end state, and I just wanted to zoom in on that phrase for a little bit. When we look back at the Cold War, yes, it was protracted, and many U.S. policymakers and intelligence officials, even up until shortly before the Cold War ultimately concluded, were preparing themselves for a confrontation that would last indefinitely. And yet, we can look back and say definitively that there was a victor and there was a loser. We can look back and say that, yes, the Cold War, it did consume the better part of a half century, but the United States ultimately prevailed and the Soviet Union ultimately lost. Now, can one disclaim that possibility in the current context? No, and one can very rarely theoretically rule out certain possibilities. And so, is it theoretically possible that the Chinese Communist Party might collapse, that China suffers this great internal disintegration, and subsequently the Chinese competitive challenge disappears? It is a theoretical possibility. Is it a theoretical possibility that there is a direct armed confrontation between Washington and Beijing, and that Beijing suffers so catastrophically that it decides to recalibrate fundamentally its strategic disposition vis-a-vis Washington the way that Japan and Germany did after World War II? Again, it is a theoretical possibility. But having laid out those theoretical possibilities, I think the far stronger likelihood is that China, for all of its weaknesses at home and for all of its challenges abroad, that China is likely to endure as a competitor. And a scholar and practitioner for whom I have just the utmost admiration, Ryan Haas, who is at the Brookings Institution currently, the two of us, we wrote an article a few years ago at this point, in which we referred to China, or we tried to characterize China as an enduring but constrained competitor. And I'll just say a word about, I'll comment on both the enduring aspect of China, the constrained part. So enduring. I think if you compare China with, so China is more formidable than I think any other competitor the United States has faced externally. If you look at the size of China's economy, if you look at the level of integration of China's economy into the global economy, if you look at China's technological capacity, if you look at its military power, if you look at its population size, and we could go on and on and on, but I think suffice it to say that China, for all of its complications at home and abroad, that China has very significant strengths. And China also, importantly, it has certain strengths that the United States cannot readily replicate. One other significant advantage, competitive advantage that China has is its extant level of centrality in global supply chains for a range of vital commodities. So for those reasons and others that Ryan and I try to articulate in this article for foreign policy, we think that China is likely to endure as a competitor. But we also say, in the second part of the depiction or the characterization, that China is constrained. So if you look at China's growth outlook, for example, so it does appear now that China's growth on a structural, systemic basis appears to be slowing. Its demographic outlook is quite grim. I think that China's investment climate is proving to be less hospitable to outsiders because of some of the decisions that Xi Jinping and his top advisors have made around prioritizing the political control over the CCP over over certain market, more market-oriented reforms. If you look at Xi Jinping's growing sort of concentration of political power and the consequent lack of exposure to advisors and advice that might offer contrarian views. And then externally, because of actions that I think largely because of actions that, that China has taken, we see growing coalescence among advanced industrial democracies to contest China on a multifaceted basis. So when you combine China's increasingly pronounced internal challenges, its increasingly contested external environment, I think that China is fundamentally a constrained competitor. So what is the net of that assessment for U.S. foreign policy? The net of it is that I don't think that the United States should predicate its policy towards China on the hope or the assumption of Chinese collapse. At the same time, it shouldn't succumb to undue alarm about China's long-term strategic outlook. I don't think, and as again, as Ryan and I say in this article that I just mentioned, you know, China is not on a glide path to global hegemony. So what it means is that the Cold War is probably not the best, you know, the best source of historical guidance, because I think that China is likely to endure. So what I've tried to argue in perhaps more recent, you know, writing and speaking is that the United States needs to avoid sort of, you know, twin perils. I think one peril, which is, I think, the peril to which the United States succumbed, you could say, roughly between the end of the Cold War and, let's say, the onset of the global financial crisis. One peril is that of underestimation, and underestimation breeds complacency. The twin peril is that of consternation, and that is when you aggrandize China beyond what is objectively warranted, because that kind of aggrandizement breeds consternation. So it's important for the United States, in order to kind of right-size the competitive challenge that China presents, to avoid both complacency and consternation. And you know, there's a quip that I often quote, because I think it captures so much in a very pithy and kind of humorous way. Jude Blanchett at CSIS, you know, he articulated this quip in an article that he wrote in late 2020, in which he said, if you want to kind of right size the competitive challenge from China, you know, think of China as being not 2 feet tall or 10 feet tall, but maybe 6 foot nine. So 6 foot nine is still very tall. It's a very formidable player. But it's not 10 feet tall. It's not kind of a juggernaut. So I think that the United States needs to think about what a competitive coexistence with China would look like. It needs to think about how, more about how it can replenish its own unique sources of competitive advantage rather than, as you were saying in your question, rather than allowing China to dictate the trajectory of its foreign policy. And I think that also, and I'll conclude here, I think it's also just important for narrative purposes. There are, now I don't want to suggest that all Chinese policymakers or all Chinese commentators share the view that the United States is in terminal decline. Certainly not. And there was a very good article in The Diplomat magazine a few months ago saying that that view is indeed not unanimously shared. But there are certainly powerful elements within China's national security apparatus that remain convinced that China is broadly resurgent and that the United States is broadly declining. And a big part of that kind of, you know, narrative momentum that I think that China has managed to accomplish is China looks at the way that the United States engages with its allies and partners, and also the way that the United States engages with so-called middle powers in developing countries. When the more that the United States centers its interactions with other countries around contesting China, the more I think that the United States ultimately projects anxiety as opposed to confidence, and the more that the United States, albeit unwittingly, lends credence to those narratives that the CCP is trying to promulgate, that China is inexorably resurgent and the United States is terminally declining. The more that the United States, in its interactions with countries around the world, the more that it focuses on what it affirmatively offers. So the more the more that the United States focuses on restoring the power of its democratic example, the more the United States focuses on articulating its own affirmative vision of international order, I think that the more that it will project confidence in the face of this increasing competitive challenge from China. So I realize kind of a long-winded and probably not the most satisfactory answer to your question, but just to summarize, we should certainly mind the Cold War for historical lessons, but we shouldn't overlearn from the Cold War. I think that we should prepare ourselves for a competition with China that likely is going to last indefinitely, but we should right-size the competitive challenge from Beijing. We should avoid complacency, but we should also avoid consternation. And we should remind ourselves that, you know, the United States has defied many prognostications of terminal decline. And there's no reason in theory why the United States cannot continue to defy those prognostications going forward.
Right. I like that height analogy. So in NBA terms, that would make China a power forward if it's,
absolutely,
you know, 6'9". But, you know, players and states don't quite play the traditional role they did in, let's say, unipolar order or the NBA of the 1980s and 1990s. So now we have centers that that shoot three-pointers and play on the outside as well as in, exactly, in the paint. And so the multipolar world order is very much like today's NBA.
Exactly.
So, you know, you say China is not on a glide path toward global hegemony and that it's a constrained competitor. But, you know, if the goal is managing China's rise and not defeating it, then would that mean that we're going to concede some ground to China in terms of global power? And this would maybe be a tough question to answer, but I kind of want to put this in terms that are relevant to, let's say, ordinary Americans.
Sure.
A generation ahead, how do you think their lives will be different? What things, let's say, they take for granted today, might they not enjoy in a world in which China is much, much more powerful?
Right. I think, and I appreciate the question because I find that your question actually sort of is a reminder for me as well, that I think that, you know, I sometimes, you know, when I talk about the relationship between the United States and China, I sometimes tend to talk about it in so-called strategic or geopolitical terms, but it is the world's most consequential bilateral relationship. And the evolution of the relationship between the two countries that possess the world's largest economies, it is going to have an inordinate impact, on the lived experiences of not just Americans and Chinese, but citizens around the world. So I think that one potential consequence, just to make the competitive challenge a bit more visceral or a bit more sort of real in terms of sort of lived experiences. So, you know, imagine, if China were to be substantially more, powerful, substantially more influential, and if the relationship with the United States were to grow ever more acrimonious, you could imagine a scenario or scenarios in which China, weaponizes, so to speak, weaponizes its economic and technological heft more aggressively. And so if China were to, as one example, so right now the United States is making a concerted push to accelerate its transition towards kind of its green transition, so to accelerate its transition towards more renewable sources of energy. Well, many of the crucial inputs that will be necessary to sustain that green transition originate in China. So China could play, if it wanted to, China could play, I think, a significant role in limiting America's ability to embark on, I think, this long overdue green transition. And then it just at a much more sort of practical level, and I think you were getting, you were making this point sort of near the outset of our conversation. I don't think that Americans sufficiently appreciate just the extent to which, Chinese commodities do, shape how we conduct our daily lives. I mean, when you think about the role that Chinese inputs play in, a lot of the devices that we use in our day-to-day lives to communicate, to work, to socialize, a situation in which, the United States and China were, let's say, to approach something approximating decoupling, or a situation in which a substantially more powerful China were to weaponize its economic and technological clout more aggressively, could mean that the ability of Americans, again, to communicate, to work, to socialize, could be substantially impeded. And it's for that reason, and again, I really appreciate this question that you posed, because there's a tendency, and again, lest I be sanctimonious, I sometimes indulge this tendency mistakenly. There's a tendency to talk about the consequences of an ever deteriorating U.S.-China relationship in kind of abstract geopolitical terms, but it would have very real human consequences. And in the most extreme scenario that we talked about earlier, God forbid, if the United States and China were to go to war, it really is difficult to overstate how catastrophic the consequences would be in terms of lives lost, in terms of military losses, economic losses, but really the global economy would come to a standstill. The ability of citizens around the world to just go about their daily lives would be substantially if not irrevocably, altered, you know, for the worse. And so, so I hope that, and so, you know, one of my, you know, I recently joined the International Crisis Group, so I'm quite new in the role. But you know, one of my objectives in my role as a research and advocacy advisor at the International Crisis Group, you know, one of my objectives is to try and identify and try and articulate in more vivid ways than what I see currently, the costs of not just the worst case scenario of sort of a war between the two countries, but you know, even sort of short of that catastrophe, but to present in fuller view and more sort of visceral view, the consequences of an ever-growing acrimony between the two countries, because it's that kind of presentation that I think will be essential to focusing the minds of policymakers in Washington and Beijing, to bringing them back from the precipice of war, to making them more sort of amenable to diplomacy and limited, you know, cooperation. So I see that's sort of the role that I see myself, you know, playing at least to some extent here at Crisis Group. So the more that we can humanize the costs of conflict, the more that we can humanize the costs of a sustained deterioration of the relationship, I think the more likely it is that we will at least be able to mitigate, maybe not prevent all bad outcomes, but at least preempt the very worst outcomes, and to the extent that unfortunate outcomes occur, to mitigate them more expeditiously.
Right. And there are so many ways in which we, you know, just in how we consume, in the value of our currency that, you know, we just take for granted. And, you know, for example, if the dollar plays a lesser role as a currency of global trade and the yuan gains a substantial chunk of that, then price stability and things like that here in the United States is more under question.
And
we're more vulnerable to these kind of fluctuations in the global economy based on the patterns, behavioral patterns of others.
And
America, in many ways, is an island. It's, you know, the world's largest island in economic and a strategic sense. And we are, in some ways, drifting a bit back towards Pangaea and that proximity to the rest of the world is more visceral, I think. And, you know, we see this with the migrant crisis and with other issues.
Sure.
And so COVID and the Russia-Ukraine war. And so I think there may have to be a kind of psychological adjustment over an extended time period in terms of the relative loss of U.S. power. And so, you know, many older Americans are used to being either the world's sole superpower or a very dominant player in a bipolar world order. And things are going to get a lot more complicated. You know, it's unclear how things are going to be headed over the next few generations, but complicated is an easy way to describe it.
Well, just as a word, if I may, because I think you hit on an element which is incredibly important. You know, I would argue that in many ways, and just to make, you know, this conversation a little bit more, you know, personal, you know, I came of age when kind of post-Cold War triumphalism was at its peak. And, you know, so when I was growing up, I regarded a certain level of American preeminence almost as akin to a constitutional amendment. It just, it didn't occur to me that level of preeminence could change. And certainly, you know, when I was growing up in the 1990s, if you had said to me that only three decades later, that two countries that we thought, that many thought were confidently had confidently been relegated or decisively relegated to the wrong side of history would be contesting the United States in the ways that they are presently, I would have been incredulous. And so when you said, I think you use the word either sort of psyche or psychological, but I think that in many ways, the foremost competitive challenge for the United States in the years and decades ahead, not only in dealing with China, but also in just adjusting to an evolving international system more broadly, an international system in which developing countries have greater sway, in which middle powers, so-called middle powers, are increasingly leveraging a U.S.-China strategic competition to enhance their own freedom of foreign policy maneuver. I think that one of the United States' foremost challenges in this increasingly complicated environment is psychological, and that is when only a few decades ago, you know, many, you know, policymakers and commentators believed that the United States had kind of won history, so to speak, and that certain countries were on the wrong side of history, and that henceforth, democracy, capitalism, you know, the American, you know, conception of international order would more or less proceed from strength to strength. It is very psychologically distressing when manifestations of antithetical conceptions are asserting themselves in the way that they are now. And so a big challenge for the United States will be, you know, how to again achieve and proceed with competitive composure. And I think that, you know, and here's where I think analysis, you know, research and analysis have very important roles to play. I think it's important to conduct sort of on a ongoing real-time basis, sort of net assessments of America's competitive strengths and weaknesses, but also those of China. And, you know, my kind of, you know, tentative net assessment is, you know, as I said, with China, I think it's an enduring competitor, but also constrained. We shouldn't underestimate it. We shouldn't overestimate it. And the United States, certainly, it doesn't command the relative influence that it enjoyed, say, in 1991 or 1945. But the United States has also not been relegated to sort of second-tier status. It is still the world's most powerful country. It has the most powerful military. It has the largest economy. It continues to demonstrate, you know, creativity, ingenuity, and flexibility in terms of reinvigorating core alliances and partnerships. It continues to be, you know, I think the world's leading sort of destination for talent. And so I think it's important that the United States not, its introspection is good, or sort of introspection is good. But I think when introspection lapses into, or it morphs into self-flagellation, or when it lapses into alarmism, it becomes corrosive rather than healthy. And so I think that as long as the United States, recognizes it needs to be cognizant of its the more constrained environment in which it's operating. But the United States is not alone in being constrained. China faces constraints. Russia faces constraints. And so I think that if the United States sort of takes stock of its own competitive strengths and it doesn't diminish those, and if it takes stock of the competitive liabilities of, say, China or Russia and doesn't aggrandize them beyond what is objectively warranted, then hopefully it can, recognizing even that it's more limited, it can still nonetheless achieve and proceed with competitive, I think, clarity and equanimity.
Right. And America's had a pretty great long run. And I think a big part of that is that it's a magnet for the world strivers. And so those who want to innovate want to come here. They come to Silicon Valley. They come to New York. They come to Texas, or at least Austin, maybe not the rest of Texas. But and then, you know, those who may not have you know, formal education or technical skills but want to work, they come to this country, and they do so at great peril because of what this country is known for and what it affords people. And I think many of those who've had experience living in other societies that are unfree, or that their actions or agency is constrained by, let's say, over-government regulation or an authoritarian state, can feel, you know, the palpable sense of freedom here, in that you can breathe freely and act freely. It's not a perfect society, but the kind of the social ethic here and the political system, in as much as it remains today, is inherent to the greatness of this country. And that comes not from, you know, how many aircraft carriers we have, but from the agency and the productivity and the integrity and the sense of purpose of the individual American. And that individual American, maybe who was born here or who's become an American by virtue of naturalization. And so
right.
I think it's important to have that level of confidence, and for political actors here to, you know, stop going at each other and sort of end the political chaos here that we've seen in recent years.
Right.
Now, final question. In addition to your own book, what are three books that you'd recommend to our listeners to help them get a better understanding of where China is headed and how it may shape the future world order?
I'm so excited that I was really looking forward to this question, because my, I do podcasts from time to time, and my greatest source of joy is when I get to spotlight the work of others. And so it's difficult to pick only three, but I will, I'll limit myself, just for the purposes of this question, I'll limit myself to three books. One of them is brand new. One of them is quite new. One of them is actually a decade old, but I think I've been rereading it, and I think that it's newly relevant. And so I want to flag it. So the first book that I'll mention it's brand new. It was published just at the beginning of the month, a little over a week ago. It's called A Life in the American Century, and it's Zhou Nai's memoir. And yeah, I think that Zhou Nai, it's when you read the book, I mean, it's incredible to, you know, to see kind of the emergence, the experiences that shaped, you know, the scholar sort of slash practitioner who is, you know, far and away one of the most influential in shaping how, you know, observers around the world think about geopolitics. And so I mention his book not only because he is such a commanding figure and he's been such a generous mentor to me. And so I've really enjoyed reading his book, but also because I think that Joe Nye he's a very important voice in kind of right when we think about how the United States should compete with China. You know, he is an invariably nuanced voice. And I think that he, you know, makes the argument that, yes, you know, China certainly is far more capable today on a multidimensional basis, but the United States retains a range of unique competitive advantages. And so so his book, it's really a memoir. It's brand new. It's a really fascinating and often poignant account of his, you know, personal, intellectual, professional evolution. And he certainly, as he turns to near the conclusion of the memoir, as he turns to present geopolitics, he obviously has a lot of really nuanced and I think important commentary on China. So that's my first book recommendation. So the second book was published last year, but it's still, you know, quite new, and I think it couldn't be more apropos, in light of Taiwan's recent presidential election. And it's a book called U.S.-Taiwan Relations: Will China's Challenge Lead to a Crisis? And it's a book by Ryan Haas, Bonnie Glazer, and Richard Bush. And the three of them are I think some of, you know, for my money, are some of the very, very, very best scholars in terms of, again, just consistently, you know, nuanced, rigorous, dispassionate analysis. And I think that I wouldn't presume to sort of distill such a rich account down to just a sentence or two, but I think that the upshot of their analysis is that China's challenge does not inevitably have to lead to a crisis. It could, but it doesn't inevitably have to lead to a crisis. And if the United States, China, and Taiwan play their cards right, and if they try to put some space between domestic politics and geopolitics, that a crisis over the Taiwan Strait can yet be averted. And then the third and final book I want to mention, and as I said, it's not new. It's in fact actually was published almost exactly a decade ago to the date. It's an edited volume by Nina Hashigian, who she's currently the special representative for city and state diplomacy at the State Department. And immediately prior to rejoining the State Department, she was the first deputy mayor for international affairs for the city of Los Angeles. But at the time when she edited this volume in 2014, so it's called Debating China, the U.S.-China Relationship in 10 Conversations. And at the time when she edited this volume, she was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And I love the impetus for the book, and I love the kind of the structure of the book. So what Ambassador Hashigian does in this edited volume is she identified, what she did, I should say, for this edited volume, she picked sort of 10 kind of thorny issues in the bilateral relationship. And I imagine that today we could probably expand that list from 10 to 20 or 30 or 50. But she picked sort of 10 kind of contentious aspects of the relationship. And she invited high-profile U.S. and Chinese scholars to write letters to one another. And they basically debated 10 contentious aspects of the bilateral relationship. And those letters bringing together 10 pairs of U.S. and Chinese scholars to discuss 10 contentious issues in the relationship, she edited those letter exchanges, put them into this wonderful volume, again, entitled Debating China, the U.S.-China Relationship in 10 Conversations. It came out almost exactly a decade ago to the date. And I think that we need more of, especially when you think about how badly the relationship between the United States and China has deteriorated in the interregnum, I would love to see kind of a successor volume that brings together today, in the year 2024, brings together, you know, leading U.S. and Chinese scholars to, again, write letters to one another on thorny aspects of the relationship. I think that the more any relationship is strained, the more it behooves the parties to that relationship to make renewed efforts to reengage, to exchange ideas. And look, those exchanges, they don't have to be starry-eyed. And in fact, they shouldn't be. They should be honest. They should be transparent. They should be fulsome. But I like the structure of the book. I like the motivation behind the book. And so even though it's now a decade old, it to me at least feels newly resonant. So those are three recommendations. I could easily provide many more, but I'll leave it at that.
And that was Ali Wine of the International Crisis Group. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.